Well, are we ready to begin? Are the mics working?
Yeah, we've got a couple that will be here shortly, we hope. But we're gonna...
All right, I suggest we go ahead and start. My name is Gene Simmons. I'm the chief scientist at MSC. My contribution to the discussion today will be minimal. I am relying mostly upon the experts who are seated to my right. I propose that I introduce them in sequence, and then we will ask each one to give you a two-minute statement of the most significant findings of their own work in layman's language. Next to me is Dr. Tatsumoto. Yes, indeed. I do not know his first name, and I apologize.
I think no one can pronounce it. You show me.
I have known him always as Tot.
First name is Mitsunobu, Mitsunobu. Last name is Tatsumoto. They call me Tot.
He is with the U.S. Geological Survey in Denver. Next is Professor Eugene Shoemaker of Caltech. Professor Jerry Wasserberg, also of Caltech. Professor, I'm sorry, what is your first name, Jerry?
G.J.
Next is Dr. Paul Gast of the Lamont Daugherty Observatory of Columbia University. And next to him is Dr. Ed Anders. I at least know the city, Chicago. Is it the University of Chicago? I lucked out. And Dr. J.V. Smith, also of the University of Chicago. I suggest that we start with Ed Anders for these two-minute summaries and simply come along this way.
All right, we measured a number of rare elements in lunar samples, and our principal findings are the following. First, we saw that... could the mic be turned on, or shall I yell?
Just put your mouth up to it, Ed.
Okay. We measured some 16 rare elements in lunar samples, and our conclusions refer in part to the soil of the moon, and which covers most of the seas, and in part to the lunar rocks, which are the bedrock underneath. First, for the soil, we were able to show that approximately 2% of it must come from meteorites, and this means that people have to be careful when they make measurements of lunar soil because of this meteoritic contamination. We think we have also shown what kind of meteorite was most predominant in the soil. It seems that the great majority of the meteoritic material falling on the moon was of carbonaceous chondrite composition. Now, this is a rather celebrated kind of meteorite which contains organic compounds and which has sparked many lively controversies in the last decade. The conclusion seems to be that this is really the most common type of meteorite in space, although very few have ever reached the ground on Earth. The reason being that they are destroyed in the atmosphere because of their great friability. Then one of the pieces of information that may amuse you is that something like 98% of all the gold on the lunar surface appears to come from meteorites. The amount is much too small to finance the space program, in case you were wondering. Then the last point is, looking at these same elements in the rocks of the moon, we were struck by the very low abundances in which they occur, perhaps 100 times lower than on the surface of the Earth. Now, most of these elements are quite volatile at high temperatures, and the conclusion we'd like to draw is that very early in its history, the moon went through a high temperature stage when these elements were essentially cooked off. And this certainly checks with Dr. Tatsumoto's findings that the primordial lead on the moon has a very low abundance, and most of the lead on the moon has since then formed by radioactive decay. Lead also is a volatile element.
Our study was one which was aimed particularly at understanding the igneous rocks on the moon. I think that the major conclusion that comes out of looking at the chemistry, at least so far that I've been able to look at it, is that these igneous rocks are extensively differentiated liquids. By that, I do not mean that the moon, I don't want to conclude that the moon as a whole is chemically differentiated like we picture the Earth, but these volcanic flows or liquids which were apparently crystallized or was crystallized at Tranquility Base 3.5 or 3.7 billion years ago crystallized in such a way that more than half of the starting material is no longer present where we see it or was left behind somewhere else. And this is what we mean by a differentiated liquid. The main minerals that are involved in this, according to our study, are plagioclase and olivine. I think a second point I'd like to make, which amplifies simply and perhaps disagrees with a little bit what Dr. Andrews said, the volatile element content, as is seen in the alkali metals in particular, sodium, potassium, rubidium, and cesium, of the moon is very low. In this way, we can compare the moon with the Earth. We can also compare the moon with the Earth by means of the strontium isotope composition and by means of the inferred ratio of rubidium to strontium, which you get from the strontium isotope composition. All of these comparisons indicate that the moon, like the Earth, relative to the Sun and relative to chondritic meteorites, all chondritic meteorites, is very depleted in the alkali metals and presumably in other volatile elements. My picture is that this may have happened before the material that we now see on the moon actually was accreted to form the moon, that this happened at a very high temperature stage, very early in the history of the solar system, when solids were being separated from gaseous material.
The principal matters which we actually concerned ourselves with were the ages of the rocks and lunar surface, their radiation history in terms of the exposure to bombardment by galactic cosmic rays, and are really the principal things about which we concerned ourselves. Most of the other issues were already touched upon and are redundant. For fun, of course, we looked at the surface features, and they're just spectacular and beautiful, and you find all sorts of wonderful things like broken glass balls with pits on them which cause secondary melting, and pieces of iron meteorites which came in, which themselves have been caused to generate these little flowers due to hypervelocity impacts. The main conclusions about our work are really fairly simple. The statements which I will make will be made as if the things were generally true and that we had looked at samples from a lot of other places, which we have and we have not. The lava flows, the Sea of Tranquility, are 3.65 billion years old. This is almost exactly 1 billion years after the moon formed. The moon, in fact, formed at the same time as the other planetary objects of the solar system within 10 million years. The exterior of the moon was made molten at least to a depth of 100 kilometers by impact or internal heat, and at sometimes lavas were generated at 3.65 billion years. If this is related to impact, that means that we had the heck beat out of us 3.65 billion years ago, which might be an explanation as to why there isn't a good geological record on the Earth. The other thing is that the moon cannot have been made by pulling it off the Earth in what is popularly called a theory, but it's just sort of a random walk guess by people with nothing better to do. If it did happen, the data, I think, almost unequivocally prove that it happened within the first 200 million years of the moon's existence. It never could have happened subsequent to that time. The other things which may be of interest. Yes. If the moon were ripped out of the Earth, it had to happen prior in the first 200 to 300 million years of the moon's history. It could never have happened subsequently. Well, you want a popular explanation of that or what? The isotopic composition of strontium is so, strontium 87 in particular, is so low in abundance, and it's very hard to fractionate isotopes. So that even if you ripped all the elements apart in almost any way whatsoever, you would end up with a very good sample of what the isotopic composition was. That is, you can take a piece of chalk and do a lot of chemistry to it and still have not changed the strontium isotopic composition. We know what the Earth's strontium isotopic composition is as a function of time approximately. It's just way stuck way in the air, and you can't get it unless you wait to the very, very beginning where they all started at the same material. So basically the statement is the only way you can have it the same strontium isotopic composition is to go back early enough in time so that these things converge. This argument is, I think, fairly powerful. If this idea, if it may be called such, is true, it was prior to this time.
May I suggest that we hold some of our questions until later?
Then one other important result is that, assuming the data are right, that there are pieces of the moon which are still much older than 3.65, namely about 4.4 billion years old, a little bit younger than the age of the moon, but pretty old. So that there's a good chance that a lot of the rocks which will be found, possibly in highland sites or in other areas, will reflect even a more primitive history than we see on the Mari site, which has currently been occupied. I think to first order, that is the closest summary I'd like to make.
The data that I presented this morning, it's not data. I'm a ringer in here. I presented some numbers that were derived by pencil and paper rather than by doing the elegant things that most other people on this podium have done. Actually based upon a model of how the lunar soil layer, or regolith, which is a term I prefer for this, how it is formed. The model is very simple. It assumes that the regolith is formed almost entirely by repetitive bombardment of the surface by meteoroids and by flying bits and pieces of the moon itself. If you construct this model, if you adopt a flux rate of particles of different size, then you can make certain kinds of numerical predictions. And in fact, what I did was to count, first of all, show that the small craters up to diameters of about 140 meters at Tranquility Base are craters that represents a population which is steady in time. The numbers of craters per unit area doesn't change because they're being ground away as fast as you're making them. Above 140 meters, the craters, you see all the craters that have ever been made. Statistically, most of them are there. Few, of course, are lost. Therefore, you can count those craters, numbers as against size, and get this flux rate for the larger craters. The numbers I gave are based on extrapolating that production curve down to very tiny craters. From this, you can predict, for example, how thick the soil layer should be. The prediction can be checked with a number of observations. It turns out the mean predicted thickness, or rather the median predicted thickness, is 4 meters. That's right in the middle of the observations that we have as we look at orbiter photographs. It's also consistent with other ways of calculating the thickness, which Dr. Wasserberg could tell you about later. We get a similar number. You can predict the rate at which rocks get ground down and destroyed, and you can compare those predicted ages with the exposure ages that are calculated, and so on. I gave a number of predictions, and they are then to be checked against what you've already heard this morning and will hear from other people who are making the measurements. The agreement is good enough between the predictions and the observations to date that I think one can start to have some fair confidence that this model is right. That is, you build a soil layer up simply by repeated turning over by small craters, starting with a bedrock layer. in this case probably a lava flow. You would not get this agreement if there were other major mechanisms producing the soil layer. Now, the soil layer is not an ashfall layer produced by a volcano somewhere. The soil is not being transported by mysterious mechanisms from the highlands and deposited on the Mare. You cannot possibly get this agreement if the model is wrong. So I think that what I'm saying is that the power of doing this sort of mathematical model is you make a number of predictions, and now we have a large variety of observations to check it against, and those checks start to look relatively good.
Our primary study was to determine the age of lunar samples. And the, as I told you, that lead is the most powerful method to determine the age of the solar object, because there is isotope pair that uranium 238, 235 decay to the lead 206 and 207, so that some kind of metamorphism doesn't separate the between daughters, so that the age determined is more accurate than the other method. But however, we have this advantage that, as you know, that lead is loaded in the atmosphere from the automobile exhaust pipe, so that the experiment is not so easy. We must eliminate the contamination from the atmosphere. So we have a high pressure room, air filter in the penthouse, and forced into the room. Never is dirty air coming into the room. Surprisingly, this lunar sample is lead in the lunar sample is radiogenic, so that we can get the rather accurate age of the moon or moon rock. Beside of that, my colleague John Rochel studied the uranium isotopes, that means 238, 235, and 234, and thorium isotopes, that means 232, 230, and 228. All uranium and thorium isotopes is similar with the terrestrial composition, but the only thorium 230 is not equilibrated with the parent 238 in three samples, and we don't know the answer for that. We must study for more lunar sample and should put the conclusion. That's all.
I think probably it's best if Dr. Agrell speaks before me, because we deliberately arranged that he would talk about the petrology and I would talk about the mineralogy.
Okay, Joe. Agrell, University of Cambridge. Our work was fundamentally concerned with the description of the mineral characteristics and components of the rocks of the moon, and to try from this description to interpret the conditions under which the rocks had crystallized, only taking what you might call a one-stage inference, not a three- or four-stage inference, into the what you might call an origin of the history of the moon. This kind of work involves the separation and analysis of minerals, preferably by non-destructive techniques, over very small areas, so that you can, let us say, determine the way in which the composition of a mineral varies over a given period of time, and then, having the variation of all the minerals, then you are enabled to describe the, you have, so to speak, the alphabet, which enables you to describe the sentence, which is the word, which is the rock, as a whole, and to characterize it, and to characterize it in such a way that you define things which are which are significant and allow you to say there are here in the Tranquility Base. We had a little piece of rock and a little bit of dust collected from an area of about 50 square miles, 50 square yards, kind of this is, and yet some of this material may have come from very far afield. Oh, there's a dead one. May have come from very far, very far afield. And this is really an exciting thing, you know, to think that you, that perhaps among these one little particle that you pick up of a rock that you're describing, that maybe this thing had blown in from an enormous distance. And then when you, this idea, I suppose you have, before you look at the moon at all. And then you then begin to look at the other features of these things, and you say, well, yes, I can determine the composition of them. I can, as Ed Chow here has done particularly, recognize that they've been subject to enormous shock pressures, and therefore that some of these particles have been produced by meteoric bombardment of the moon. How far away do they come? Do they come from? Can I distinguish these glassy particles, their various compositions, from glasses, let us say, which might have been formed by a solar flare or some flame passing across the surface of the moon? It seems to me that lunar geology, you know, is something which is quite different. You have to forget about earthly geology. All this happens, you know, 4 billion years ago. And earthly geology, there are a whole lot of processes which don't happen on the moon, and one sits with a special kind of blinkers on one, which, well, from my point of view, it doesn't allow one to be, I suspect, imaginative enough. And, it's trying to read a history out of the, all right, as Ruskin said, it was a sermon in stone when he picked up a piece of chalk and described it. Thank you.
I'd like to continue from there, and I'd like to emphasize what a little bit of material we worked with. The material was broken up in the lunar receiving laboratory and distributed to many people, and to some extent it was a lucky dip what you got. You put your finger in, you pulled out a plum, or you just happened to miss it. It wasn't in your piece. So there's going to be a lot of augmentation of the data that we presented today. Roughly what I looked at with my colleagues, especially Fred Anderson and Bob Newton, was the area of 3 postage stamps and a thimble full of material. And from this we try and reconstruct some properties. We would like to suggest that the crystalline rocks melted about 1140 degrees centigrade on the basis of experiments done on similar material compositions at Chicago and on a basis of the comparison of the mineral assemblages. We want to suggest that the iron on the moon at this area is highly reduced because there's very little ferrous iron, which is a type known commonly in rust, red rust. There's very little of that in the minerals. In fact, we'd like to say that the pressure of free oxygen on the moon is about 1/1000th of that on Earth, an equivalent essentially to what is found in meteorites. There'll be a lot of dispute about the exact value as the conference goes on because the technicalities are really very complicated. We would like to have a mechanism for producing the high iron and titanium of some of the rocks that is similar to things we've seen on Earth. This may not be work out. There may be some subtle differences that will make it difficult. But we have been trying to explain the rocks by melting and floating of crystals that are lighter than the liquid and dropping of crystals that are heavier, forming mixtures of liquid and crystals which can be then later remelted or moved around on the surface. These will be highly controversial, and I don't want to go into the particular details. But we do believe that we can get the high iron and titanium content, which is a local phenomenon in this area of the moon, by crystal liquid differentiation processes. Stuart Agrell showed slides, which he forgot to mention, of glass balls studied by the scanning electron microscope, and that was mentioned earlier. We also did this, but we didn't describe them, except that we showed some analyses which we believe show that the glass balls were consistent with volatilization under a reducing atmosphere. If
people want to claim that glass balls are formed by fiery rain falling back onto the surface after splashing up from the surface by, say, a meteorite impact or possibly by volcanic activity, then we would say that the chemistry would be consistent with this. The morphology, of course, is very intriguing. Impact craters. We've got balls that look like golf balls, which is the sort of thing that newspaper reporters love to put in articles. They dimpled. Probably some sort of bubbling phenomenon, but maybe you've got better pictures than I have, and maybe yeah. you...
But we call ours plum puddings, just after Christmas, man.
Now, there are many amateur mineralogists in this country who want to know what particular minerals are there. Well, the minerals that are there are what you typically find in basalts, except the compositions are different. You have the essential absence of ferric iron. I did describe one mineral that has been found by half a dozen groups of investigators. It is the iron analogue of a very rare mineral called pyrox mangite. And I think you'll find as the conference goes on, there'll be about two or three new minerals will be described.
We have one additional speaker who came in late, Dr. Ed Chao, C-H-A-O, from the U.S. Geological Survey in Washington.
The work we presented this morning are in general about twofold in purpose. One is that we would like to find out what type of unshocked materials are returned in the Apollo 11 samples. This is important as a part of the study to try to understand the evolution of the volcanic rocks in the first place and what happened to these volcanic rocks after they had been bombarded by meteoritic impacts. We are also interested in the degree of this kind of bombardment or deformation as a result of such impacts. It is quite important that we know and be able to distinguish the various details in those rocks that have not been affected by meteoritic impact and those rocks that did. And our major interest, therefore, revolves around the mineralogical composition, the textural varieties, that has to do with the sequence of crystallization later on, the history of evolution of these kinds of rocks. And we discuss a little bit about what happens when these volcanic rocks were subsequently bombarded or modified by meteoritic impacts. Some of these chips, there are two types, a main titanium-rich rock suite, and then a subordinate or less abundant type, which is rich in feldspars. What happened to these after they are bombarded? Some of the chips show very definitive structures of deformation as a result of very high strain rate type of deformation, such as the passage of a shock wave. And those that are very intensely shocked would have fused into glass spherules and globules, which contain nickel iron particles, which contains little rock fragments, and also a high degree of inhomogeneity in their chemical composition, which indicated that most of the glass beads or glass bodies that we have investigated indeed were probably the results of meteoritic impact. This is the kind of data that we have presented this morning.
Okay, we're ready now for questions. Please raise your hands and wait for the mic, and also, whenever possible, address a question to a specific individual in that it will be very helpful to us for transcript purposes. Ed DeLong.
I wonder if someone would tackle an explanation of why the soil and breccia seem to be older than the rocks, particularly in light of Dr. Shoemaker's theory that the soil comes from the bombardment of the rocks and the breaking down of the rocks.
Well, I'm going to comment on that. I think the answer is...
It's a problem. It's a good problem that you touched upon. I think the only explanation that I can put forth right now, which is contrived, is that really you are looking... Don't forget, you're really looking at a planet that's 4.6 billion years old. And if you have not moved material around and buried it or hidden it in any way, but if you melted it or did all sorts of crazy things with it and kept it, imagine as a thin sheet, and each one had its own private age, but communally this assemblage has the same original age. It just keeps on ticking away time. And of course the dust is like a bunch of sandboys sitting there going like this with the rocks. So I think basically you're looking at a 4.6 billion year old object, rock thing, with a bunch of people melting it and smelting it and doing funny things to it, but not moving any material away. And people are chipping it and mixing it. And so they just are analyzing what looks like the average of that thick layer. No, the rock's there to begin with. And maybe the rocks are molten. But the age of the total system, if no material is lost, it keeps on clicking away time.
May I try to add to that, Jerry? I think what it's clear from some of the data that was presented by others this morning that chemically, most of the material in the dust comes from the rocks, which themselves must be local. But there is some admixture. There's a small percentage of material, not only of meteoritic contamination, but of materials that come probably from the lunar highlands. The meteoritic material is about 4.6 billion years, probably, and there are probably older materials in the highlands as well, so that you mix some of that material in, and if some of it in particular is very rich in radiogenic lead, then you could, and mix that in, then you could get the result that was reported by Dr. Tatsumoto.
Let me say the following thing. If you imagine you could take the whole Earth today, grind it up, melt it, and take then a small spoon of that and analyze it, you'd get 4.6 billion years. And I think that's really what the soil is telling you. That what it's telling you more profoundly is that somebody has not buried something very, very different much after 4.6 billion years.
I'd like to ask Dr. Smith or whoever would like to feel this. Do I understand properly that that the crystalline melted 1140 degrees centigrade, and this was the event that apparently happened 3.5 or 3.6 billion years ago? And if I do understand this properly, what do you think was the process that occurred to get such a high heating rate?
The rocks on the moon can be heated either by radioactivity or by the energy caused by infall of bodies. I don't know if we have enough data at this time to tell what proportions of energy could come from those two things. But we certainly believe a large part of the moon was melted. You can go to the extreme and say it was all melted, or you can go to the other extreme and say only a small part was melted, and there'll be lots of arguments as to the amount. We have made experiments in a laboratory, specifically Robert Newton, under conditions which we believe reproduce those in which the minerals form from these rocks, and they indicate 1140 degrees centigrade, you know, plus or minus a few degrees. And whether that's a 3.6 billion year event, other people may want to comment. But it looks like a good eruption of liquid rock, which then crystallized at that temperature.
This is both for Drs. Wasserberg and Tatsumoto. It seems to me that the age determinations for the older stuff age determinations for the older samples, the fines and the breccia, indicate that the moon has not been close enough to the Earth for extensive heating, according to Al Fain's idea, since early in the moon's history.
I don't understand.
Remember, Al Fain asked if the second event, the 3.8 billion year event, could have been the approach of the moon to the Earth and the melting that resulted.
Yes.
It seems to me the answer is, from your data, that this could only have occurred 4.6 billion years
ago, and that the moon has
never been that close to the Earth since then.
No.
And
it's an incorrect interpretation. It's not a correct interpretation. The dust. The same is true for the Earth today, which has molten rocks on it. I'm sure you could go grind it up, you know, it's a big job, and then get a sample that makes it well, and sample it, and you get 4.6 billion years, but it's had melting and so forth. So the dust is just a sort of an averaging process. So that does not answer this problem. I think the answer to the problem lies in the fact that if the Looney Rock 1 gives essentially an age of 4.5 billion years, says that if you did any sort of heating like that, you had to do it before 4.5, or else destroy it.
You mean by that then that the 4.5 billion year stuff is from deep enough down so it was not affected by this heating? Otherwise you would have rubbed out your radiogenic timetable.
No, you don't. I don't think I can answer that question right here.
I would like to ask this Dr. Tashimoto about the rocks of the moon, which is similar to the half-formed elements of the Earth, like, for example, the quartz and the smoky quartz and the crystal of the half-life, crystals of the world, of the Earth, half-life elements.
I didn't determine the half-life of the elements.
I mean, like, for example, the cobalt-16 and all this kind of we call it half elements, half formed elements.
Well, I just determined the uranium isotopes and thorium isotopes. And when I said that thorium-234 is in equilibrium with parents, that using the existence, the available decay constant, I didn't measure the decay constant or half-life.
Excuse me 1 second. I think Dr. Anders would like to make one comment on the heating sources.
Well, there are three principal heat sources available for these melting events that we've been discussing. Two were available 4.6 billion years ago. The first of these, as Dr. Smith mentioned, is the gravitational potential energy of accreting the moon. And it has been calculated if the moon formed in a very short time, something like 1,000 years, that the temperature release would be sufficient to heat it to something like 2,000 degrees. If it happened more slowly, of course, the moon wouldn't be quite as hot. Second, we know that the meteorites also underwent melting 4.5 billion years ago. There's still no agreement what caused it, but most people believe that meteorites come from small bodies. Somehow these small bodies were melted by some process. And if small bodies were melted, then presumably larger bodies should have been melted also. So there is a second heat source of perhaps somewhat uncertain origin, extinct radioactivity or what have you. And finally, there is long-lived radioactivity, which could cause melting at practically any time during the last 4.5 billion years. And there are quite a few sophisticated computer calculations of the temperature history of the moon done by Peter Fricker, Harold Urey, and other people. And they show that depending what you assume for the initial temperature and the radioactivity content of the moon, that one could get a period of intense melting something like 4.3, 4.5 billion years ago, or any time later, in fact, as recently as 1 billion years ago, if the moon had started out completely cold. So the fact that there are some rocks which seem to have melted 3.6 billion years ago do suggest that the moon started out fairly hot, and then perhaps the long-lived radioactivity caused a period of melting.
You know, the real problem with the melting of the moon, as Harold Urey pointed out long ago, is if you, which is the cold moon problem, so, you know, some like it hot and some like it cold and some like it in a pot, 4.6 billion years old, that's sort of what the problem is. If you say the moon has to maintain this difference in its structure, which is not an equilibrium configuration, then you say the moon has to have a finite strength. In order to have a finite strength and apparently no significant core, you don't want to melt it. So you want to make a cold moon. Now the problem is, how do you make a cold moon? Because everything was hot. And it was so hot that clearly there were lava flows which and melting at the outer 100 kilometers of the moon, and maybe those arguments about a cold moon will have to be relooked at. The problem is not to make something hot, the problem is to make something cold.
I don't know whether Professor Smith brought his machine gun in here, but this is a friendly crowd. Would do you care to go in and repeat your comments on the structure of the moon regarding the slides you showed at the end of your talk?
Well, this model is just for fun to get something going. Jerry Wasserberg has mentioned the distinction between a hot and a cold starting for the moon and the problem of cooling the moon off. Now, there's some problems that I'm not competent to go into, but I would like to make just a few remarks. Transfer of heat from the center to the surface is something I don't think you can just sit and calculate in an electronic computer. We don't have the basic data. I'd like to see a lot of that heat transferred out by convection currents. Another problem is the strength of the moon. The strength of a rock is, again, not a very easy thing to resolve. The presence of small amounts of hydroxyl groups, for example, promote the movement of defects such that the
rock will flow more easily. Maybe the moon is outgassed more, and therefore it's stronger than equivalent Earth rocks because it has less material that will help it to move. Now, the weakness of a rock is not something that you can readily visualize. It's a slow process that goes on over thousands or millions of years. It gives atom by atom rather than cracks like when you hit something with a hammer and split it open. These are very slow creeps. Now, all these processes are so complex, and I'm so abysmally ignorant of all the basic process of this, I wouldn't want to claim anything except that let's have a model, let's see if it will do petrologically what we want to get the magma, get the iron and titanium, outgas volatiles, give a reducing atmosphere, and let's see what the consequences are, then we'll see if they'll stand up against the other arguments that can be presented.
But the point is that your model is similar to the model of terrestrial.
Yes, we're starting with roughly the same sorts of compositions. We can mimic all those minerals in the laboratory under controlled conditions, and we know that there's going to be olivine coming out of the right composition at the right depth, and pyroxene, assume the temperatures are about the right level. And that's where we all fall down, I think, is exactly what happens to the temperature and the time relationships. I'm sure other people on the panel here would like to comment on that.
I have a feeling that we have opened up an area here in terms of models that do not satisfy all of the data, that we could find quite a few rebuttals. Yeah. I really think we should not pursue the matter of why many of us think that this model is not realistic. I think Paul Gast is burning to give at least one small explanation, so allow him to say a few words. And allow me to say that some of us have some reservations about the validity of the model fitting all of the data, in my own case, particularly the geophysical data.
I think that the question that came from the floor almost gave the answers. One of the things we have to be very careful from just unconsciously slipping into, and that is assuming that everything on the moon is like it is on Earth, assuming that because we have water on Earth that the moon started off as a hydrous body and that you somehow had got rid of the water. It's entirely possible that the moon was always anhydrous and never had any water, and then we don't have to explain it. Except we have to explain why it was anhydrous and why the moon isn't.
I'm still bothered if somebody would take one more run at this difference in age between the solid rocks and the dust. We have a situation, you can't grind up something that's 3.6 billion years old and get something that's 4.8 billion.
I explained it. I got a pot. There's no lead in it. There's uranium in it. And the pot's sitting here, and it makes lead. Okay, and it's been doing this for 4.6 billion years old. We'll put that pot over the side, okay? Now I got a pot 4.6 billion years old with uranium in it. And I sit here, and between the four of us, we scoop it back and forth into different things. Sometimes we take out lead and we put it in this pot, and sometimes we put lead in that pot and uranium in this pot, just between the four of us, and we don't drop any on the floor. Now, I scoop all this back together, take a little sample of it, and I'll measure the age. It's the same age as the other pot. That is exactly the sense of the time which I am measuring if I take an average of a mixture like this, if it is representative. Is that clear? Because I can reconstruct this. No, that's different.
That's what I want to know. If the dust comes from the ground up rock, which it surrounds, how can the rock be younger than the dust that's made out of it?
Well, no.
That's a good question.
No. The point is as follows.
You're talking about uranium.
It's the same for you being trans. The same for you. You take baby. Well, all the elements are still there. All of a sudden, he robs me out of most of my lead, and I give him a new piece of uranium. He starts again, okay? But I haven't lost any. I've still got the extra lead here. So I would have somebody that would give effectively an older age. But if I start it all back together again. No, absolutely not.
If I understand it correctly, if you have a rock and you melt it and the lead runs out of it, then that rock has a younger age. If you take that lead which has run out of it now and put it back into that rock.
No, then I give it to somebody else. He'll measure an infinite age for that rock.
Right.
the average is going
to
be right.
Yeah, then the average between the two comes back to the older age.
Right. That's basically it. As long as you don't lose anything. If you lose it, you're out of business. Yeah, the dust has pieces in it, which if you calculated, and as we have done, ages in this, exactly this sense for an individual piece of dust, you get a kooky result like 7 billion years. And there are other pieces that give the age which is too young. But it's not really 7 billion years old. It's actually a younger age. And that 7 billion represents the fact that somebody took out the rubidium out of this piece or something and dumped it into the other guy, making him too young.
If we understand the moon, can you tell me why you don't find evidence on Earth of anything 4.6 billion years old?
Well, the oldest known rocks in the Earth are 3.4 billion years old. The largest areas of old rocks in the Earth are 2.65 billion years old. There are very few 3.4 billion years old, year old things. Nobody knows the answer to your question, and it's a very good question. The first thing is you have to understand is the Earth's a pretty lively planet. Namely, the time for something to get remade on the Earth is a typical time scale of a half a billion years by remelting and erosional processes. So it's very hard to find anything that's old. It's sort of like, you know, how many 300-year-old men do you know? So they die and they get reborn in cockroaches, or if you've read Archie and Mehitabel, and sometimes cats. But there's a rejuvenation process by remelting, which gives you an individual age which is younger. The reason why there should be a cutoff could be, and probably is, due to a major catastrophic event in the first few hundred million years of the Earth's history, which perhaps was related to the formation of the crust and the mantle and the core. And so all hell broke loose sometime, or a series for a period of time.
Would that be related to the moon event?
By impact. If you use an impact model, yes.
Can any conclusion now be reached on whether any material from the moon has arrived on Earth?
Everything that people have said wasn't.
Well, I mean, other than my answer.
Tektites or any other...
Two things which we've found that people have called lunar. One is tektites, and the other is basalticate chondrites, and you can prove, I think, make a very strong case, I should not say prove, that tektites are almost certainly impossible and basalticate chondrites are very, very difficult.
What's possible?
A piece of the moon.
What did you say is possible?
I think the assumption all these years has been that it is not very difficult to throw a rock off the moon, that one can accelerate to escape velocity 2.4 kilometers per second and have it land more or less intact. And there were people, Don Galt in particular, who have studied hypervelocity impact, who always maintain that by the time you accelerate something to 2.5 kilometers per second, you have virtually melted it. And therefore that no solid rocks could ever leave the moon intact. And it seems that Don Galt may be vindicated.
The answer is there must be moon dust.
Moon dust,
in the
right.
Atmosphere. Yep. It's melted. It's in little microscopic drops, just like the drops in the microbreccia in the soil. And these things look very... If you just put a pan out and let stuff from the air fall down, you'll get little glass spheres and stuff. The trouble is, it's so contaminated with other things that fall out of the air that you have very little chance of identifying the ones which are lunar. But it's probable that people who work with these little things have had some little lunar spheres. And now that we know how to test for them isotopically, it'd be nice to go back and check and see if some of them aren't in fact lunar.
Okay, we're going to have time for about two more questions. Let's catch Ed DeLong in the back and then Sanders Lamont, who's had his hand up for a long time.
For Paul Gast, I wonder if you'd elaborate a little bit on something that I think I understood you to say but didn't hear real well, and that is that the difference between the titanium content of the basalts and the microbreccia leads you to believe that there would be a third component that would be much lower than either of them in titanium, which either no longer exists or at least did not come back in the Apollo 11 samples. Am I correct? And
you've said it very well. I mean, I think that if we had 2 days to collect material in this region, we might have found this third component. Maybe the next sample would have been it. But you can say from the mass balance that there must be something in the soil which
does not occur in the igneous rocks or in anywhere else in the sample.
Would that something be something that exists now or something that may have just existed and no longer does, no longer has an identity of its own?
I don't see why it shouldn't exist like all the other igneous rocks now. I mean,
somebody, I believe Dr. Smith said earlier that there's a possibility that several new minerals will be discovered, announced, or something in the course of this conference.
One new mineral was announced this morning. Half a dozen people have discovered it. It hasn't been given a name. It will be hopefully given a name cooperatively. And it is the iron analog of a mineral called pyroxmangite. And I'll give anyone the basic data if they so wish. Pyroxmangite. Pyroxmangite. I have names of the minerals here in handouts if anyone wants to check their copy.
So you do expect others in the course of this conference, is that correct?
Yes, we have one ourselves, which I didn't describe for time, but someone else will describe it later in the conference, and I don't want to steal any more time.
Okay, I think we better close it at this point. These gentlemen are going to... I want to grab a bite and get the afternoon session.
Not at all. I've never heard that.
Did you say iron analog?
Right, here you are. That's the name. Iron silicate, the iron analog.